Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. Today we hear the second part of the interview with David McGowan, author of Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon, Laurel Canyon, Covert Ops, and the Dark Heart of the Hippie Dream. But first, we check in with Dane Wigington, a returning guest who runs geoengineeringwatch.org. We talk about the anomalous weather pattern known as the Polar Vortex, and Dane's recent article titled The People's March Against Climate Change. Dane, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Jeff.
You wrote a number of articles, one titled The People's March Against Climate Change. Can you encapsulate that article for listeners?
My point was this. It's certainly perplexing when you have, for example, the People's Climate March that just occurred, and you have so many people gathering. For example, I think the official figures were 350 or 400,000 in the streets of New York. How can that many people who claim to be concerned about the climate, and I'm not saying their concerns are not legitimate, but how can they not know about the single greatest climate disrupting factor of all, which is global climate engineering? And that's very astounding to me. And we had a number of activists who tried to post comments on the official blog site for that march mentioning very articulately the subject of climate engineering, geoengineering, hard science subjects, hard science terms. Any comment that mentioned those terms was immediately deleted from that site. Isn't that interesting? So it seems they don't really want to know and are not willing to let any information out about the climate engineering situation, which is tearing the Earth's climate system apart. So it seems quite a hypocrisy to me that many people can march for a subject and then exclude the biggest single factor relating to that subject.
You had mentioned in a previous conversation, you called it tenacious denial.
Yes, I think that term fits. And when you have, for example, organizations like Greenpeace, which was certainly involved in the global march to expose, global warming. I was on national radio with Greenpeace's top scientists. It's been, I don't know, 8-9 months ago. And clearly he knew about climate engineering. If anybody listened to that interview, it was on Go Green Radio. If anybody listened to the interview, I think they would absolutely conclude this scientist for Greenpeace knew about climate engineering, did not want to talk about it.
Can you tell listeners what was an indicator for you that led you to believe that he knew about geoengineering, global climate engineering?
Well, I challenged him on air to try to defend his position that he was unaware of these programs, and he couldn't. Couldn't defend that position. In fact, he conceded that there may be aspects of these programs going on that is not being acknowledged. And he in no way could or even tried to offer any defense for his lack of acknowledgement of these programs. And in fact, by the end of the show, conceded that maybe it is going on. So there's a lot of lying going on, an incredible amount of hypocrisy, and an incredible amount of denial for some people who are simply making a good career decision, whether they're a meteorologist or a scientist for Greenpeace. They're making a career decision to protect their employment and avoid the truth.
Their tactic is to ignore the issue and not speak about it and delete any confrontation or debate about the topic. You don't even get a chance to debate it. They'll feign ignorance or they pretend it doesn't exist. I was at the climate march, and I did not see one sign about geoengineering or climate engineering at all. I didn't see every part of the march, but I certainly didn't see any people against geoengineering. So I was thinking recently about the polar vortex and how it's very possible with the ionospheric heaters that are set up around the northern part of the planet to slide the cold air over so oil companies and countries such as Russia, China, the United States can get into those resources. It was just an idea I was thinking about. It was really based on an article that I saw a couple days ago titled Russia Says Arctic Well Drilled with Exxon Strikes Oil. We're talking about billions of barrels of oil, hundreds of billions of dollars going into this project that will take a decade and is considered one of Vladimir Putin's greatest ambitions. As Russia's existing fields in Siberia run dry, the country needs to develop new reserves as it vies with the U.S. to be the world's largest oil and gas producer. And I thought that was interesting because I suspect that's what's going on. You hear meteorologists on TV last year saying polar vortex, this and that. But what I noticed throughout the spring and summer this year is that rotation stayed in the same place pretty much and has affected weather. And people living in Toronto, 100 miles plus and minus of that latitude, have been complaining about the aerosol operations. So it's right on the outer edge of that polar vortex there. And just speaking with you, you had already written about this in detail. Can you tell listeners what you have found?
First, if I can back up on the march itself and the lack of any geoengineering or anti-geoengineering signs, I'm quite certain the organizers of that march would not have allowed that. Wherever these people's funding is coming from, that funding seems bent on hiding or obscuring the issue of climate engineering. So when we have organizations like ETC and, again, Greenpeace or 350.org, all these groups seem either more interested in protecting their nonprofit status or hiding the subject of climate engineering altogether. To get climate engineering should be considered the greatest single climate disrupting factor, not at all the only factor, endless amount of anthropogenic forms of damage to the climate. But again, these groups are systematically eliminating any discussion of climate engineering. So when we get to issues, the polar vortex that you discussed and Russia's involvement with chasing resources, first, Russia appears to be trying, at least making some effort, to bring the subject of climate engineering to light. Last September, the only reason the IPCC mentioned the subject of geoengineering was because Vladimir Putin asked them to. Otherwise, you would have had the largest scientific panel on any subject in human history issuing a report on the climate without so much as even mentioning the term for the largest single climate-disrupting factor of all, geoengineering. So Putin appears to be trying to raise that issue, not to hide it, and I give him credit for that. Second, on the exploitation of resources, the thawing of the Arctic is not necessarily helpful for accessing those resources. In the permafrost regions of the Arctic, the thawing of the Arctic surface makes exploitation of resources in those regions exponentially more difficult, not easier. So that's a very double-edged sword. And although I know there's large multinational corporations from many countries that want to access those resources, they are having a much more difficult time doing it with some of the thawing in many areas. So although the sea ice is breaking apart and they can access more areas over the ocean, the other land areas are becoming very difficult to access. As far as the U.S. being a large oil producer, the fracking, which is the only reason that this has happened in the short term, is literally a facade. I encourage people to investigate the fracking issue. So the chase for resources is much more a quest by the Western powers than by Russia. So people need to really look at the bigger picture. Fracking is an illusion, if you will. It's produced a lot of short-term energy, but those wells are caving. The production just falls off a cliff very soon after they're put online. So there's a lot more factors to the equation. On the polar vortex, there's no question this is engineered. In fact, if people look at the NASA GISS ground surface temperature anomaly maps, you'll see that the only places that were cool last winter were the eastern half of North America, eastern Canada, eastern U.S. At the same time, you had temperatures in areas like Siberia that were off the charts to the high side. Siberia began to burn in early April of this year. It's in areas that are normally frozen solid till mid-June. So Siberia is losing 100 million acres a year to forest fires. The temperatures are off the charts. We saw Arctic Ocean temperatures this year of near 65 degrees by the Mackenzie River Delta. So this is truly a grand illusion. You're correct, Jeff, that they are pushing this cold air south. That does rob it from the Arctic, more or less. And if you see the pattern for the winter, quote-unquote winter snowstorms all winter long, they would push cold air south, completely engineered. They would combine it with moisture from the Gulf of Mexico. Now, since when do you have winter storms that originate out of the Gulf of Mexico? And in the transition zone between this cold air that's pushed south and where they're chemically ice-nucleating the moisture, you almost always had a large ice storm area where this chemically nucleated material is hitting the ground before it sets up. And this manner of storm is completely unprecedented prior to recent years. Now it's the norm because it's completely engineered. The climate engineers are tearing the climate system apart. The quote-unquote environmental groups, whatever their funding is, whatever their motives, they're helping to hide these crimes. That hypocrisy needs to be exposed, period. So we need everybody to hop into this battle and help us expose the climate engineering, or we'll soon have nothing left to save.
Dane Wigington with geoengineeringwatch.org. Thank you again for being on the show, and I know we haven't talked in a while, and this is a subject that we often do discuss on In Other News, and we'll have you back on for a longer interview. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your courage in addressing this issue.
Today we speak with author and investigator David McGowan about his book, Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon. Laurel Canyon, Covert Ops in the Dark Heart of the Hippie Dream. David McGowan briefly spoke about the book in a past interview earlier this year when we were talking about his photographic analysis of the Boston Marathon bombing. In this interview, we focus in on the book and the attention it's suddenly getting from a wide demographic. The book, Weird Scenes, reveals some very disturbing elements and connections within the birthplace of the so-called hippie movement in Laurel Canyon. The landscape itself is riddled with man-made and natural tunnel systems. Some of the tunnels are below mansions and military installations. However, the groundbreaking investigative work from McGowan is in the revealing of how so many counterculture rock stars were the children of prominent military families that all happened to converge in one location during the anti-war movement. Did all of these components accidentally come together at this time during the Vietnam War? McGowan says, probably not. David McGowan, welcome back to In Other News for the second part of the interview.
Well, thank you for having me once again.
For listeners who may not have heard this last week, can you tell us briefly about how you came to write Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon, Laurel Canyon, Covert Ops in the Dark Heart of the Hippie Dream?
I made the mistake of taking a book on vacation with me that I thought would provide some light, mindless vacation reading, and instead it just inspired this, what eventually became this book, what started out as a series of web posts and eventually grew largely by popular demand into first a book-length series of web posts and now an actual book.
Can you summarize some of the content of the book in that description, please, David?
The book basically covers the dark side of what has generally been presented as this very idyllic sort of bucolic hippie utopia where life was just couldn't have been better, and were, you know, all of these rock stars were living in this very small geographic area that kind of set off from the rest of LA and is very got a very country feel to it. It's very heavily wooded and very rustic, and you know, not at all like other parts of LA or what people picture LA being like. And it's generally been cast as this really just ideal utopian society where everyone kind of had an open door policy.
Yeah. In the first hour, we talked about the covert military aspect of it. And in a broad metaphor, a past guest on the show, listeners know, novelist and writer Professor Eric Larson. He's the author of Nation Gone Blind, America in an Age of Simplification and Deceit, and another book titled The Skull of Yorick, The Emptiness of American Thinking at a Time of Grave Peril, Studies in the Cover-Up of 9/11. Well, he wrote extensively about the cultural damage sustained from a media landscape saturated with lies and deceit. Cultural damage such as insipid, mindless music, bad artistic ideas, poor novels, bad writing. And it's interesting because here you have uncovered these covert military resources propping up a music scene and then when you peel back some layers, as you did, you find that, yeah, this hippie culture didn't spring up from the grassroots as many would like it to be remembered. Professor Larson goes on to describe it this way, and he's relating it to the lies about 9/11. There are similar lies here. He writes, "And so we come toward our end by returning to the great question that caused all of this searching. Can there be a literary life in a post-1984 nation? Can there be a literary life in a nation of the kind the United States has become over the past few decades, and especially since 9/11? The answer is very clear. No, there can't and won't be a literary life in such a time and place, nor will there be the production of a literature of depth, complexity, authenticity, significance, or durability. Why not? Because the creation of a true, real, or significant literature is impossible when a people lives or is forced to live in ignorance of the whole truth of their own lives, of their nation's lives, and the lives of those they live among. For so long as Americans continue to be deprived of or continue to be conditioned into an inability to see and know at least half the truth of what their own lives are, and at least half the truth of what their own nation is and is doing, they will remain at the very best, half people living half lives in half blindness and thinking in half thought." You compare the music of back then to now, and there's certainly a big difference in the quality.
Oh, huge difference. To my mind, the scene was definitely controlled in those days. But even given that, the music lives on, and the music had a power all of its own. And you know, to this day, you can hear these songs played on a regular basis, and they still sound good, and they still sound fresh and current in a lot of cases. And it's very, very hard. And some of the, you know, this stuff dates back to as much as 50 years. You know, the very first release was by the Byrds, Mr. Tambourine Man, in 1964, that really sparked this, the whole folk rock revolution, and eventually led to psychedelic rock and country rock and various other factions. You know, their first release in 1964 that really got the ball rolling. And you can still hear that song on the radio today, and it still sounds good. And, you know, I find it very hard to believe that 50 years from now, anyone's going to be listening to or care about, you know, Justin Bieber or Ariana Grande or Rihanna or Lady Gaga or whoever the flavor of the month is right now. You know, these artists, they have a real flash in the pan quality to them, you know, where they just sort of emerge out of nowhere as these fully formed artists with the sound and a look and a stage persona and all of this, and just seem to come out of nowhere and garner like 20 million Twitter followers and 100 million YouTube hits. The level of attention and wealth and fame that they achieve in a very short time is just so wildly out of proportion to their actual level of talent. It's like the arts have been so degraded now that the 1960s, even to the extent that it was controlled, it seems almost innocent. Today, you know, talent seems to be secondary at best, and really, if you've got a marketable face and an image, you know, they can auto-tune you and make you a star nowadays. Yeah, there's been a serious degradation of the arts, to my mind. It's very hard for me to believe that anything that's out there on the musical landscape now will have any relevance even 20 years from now, let alone 50 years from now. And I don't see any of the quote-unquote art that's being created now, and not just in the realm of music, having the kind of staying power that what was created in the 60s had.
Yes, so the manipulation was going on back in the 60s, but not at the level we're able to see now.
Yeah, see, those are kind of innocent days. Those are kind of, seem almost kind of like the test days of the star making apparatus, and now it's been refined to such an extent that they can seemingly just make anyone they want to a star virtually overnight now, and irrespective of talent or anything else. We're not moving in the right direction, that's for sure. You know, it's these processes. They've had 50 years to work on the star making process, and they seem to have become quite adept at it. And it's really sad what passes for art in this culture nowadays.
Oh, I find it interesting that Professor Larson had connected it back to a culture being saturated in lies to begin with, and not knowing the true nature of the country's direction, and being lied to, not having the truth or some aspect of the truth, then influences art.
I mean, it's hard to even know what is art these days. You know, there's been such a blurring of the line, a deliberate blurring of the lines between art and, or between news and entertainment. In incidents like Sandy Hook and in Boston and whatnot, between what is real and what is not, you know? I mean, it's hard to know when you're watching, TV or movies or whatever, if what you're watching is even real or not anymore, whether you're watching it on an entertainment channel or a news channel, you know? It's very difficult to know, you know, when you're being lied to and what's real and what's not. And to a large extent, you know, I mean, everything we're told is a lie anymore.
Very good point, David. In your book, you talk about someone named Vito Paleckis. And could you tell us where he came from and how he's connected into the Laurel Canyon hippie scene?
Yeah, he was actually a very key figure, although it took me quite a while to realize that. Again, that was a case where there was very limited information available, and I would occasionally come across his name in various books. But, it wasn't until I just kept coming across it more and more that I realized that, this guy seems to be popping up in a lot of places and connected to a lot of people. He must be more important than I thought. So then I had to go back and dig up all these facts, and still had a very hard time piecing together a very complete profile of him until I got in touch with a family member, ultimately contacted me and confidentially supplied me with some additional information to where I was able to sketch out a fairly accurate profile of this guy. And the 50s and early 60s, he was known as a sculptor, and he had a studio where he had a very elite Hollywood clientele that included people like, I think, Mickey Rooney and Jonathan Winters. Steve Allen, I think, were clients of his. So he was a pretty well-connected guy. Then in the early to mid-60s, he sort of morphed into Vito, the leader of the freak troupe, and he amassed this troupe of people around him, mostly women, frequently very young women. And he formed this sort of freestyle dance troupe that would go out to the clubs and big groups of them, and perform just these wild and crazy dance routines on the dance floors of the clubs. Initially, and this was confirmed by a number of people on the scene, who, including some of the band members, who acknowledged, the people weren't initially coming to see us; they were coming to see the sideshow on the dance floor. Because when this scene first started, I mean, it really kind of came out of nowhere, and none of these bands were known yet. You know, they were just coming out and starting to get signed and getting record deals, and all of these clubs started opening up to accommodate all of these new musical stars. And the clubs were all either brand new or recently reopened. And so the clubs didn't have an existing clientele, and the bands had no name recognition at all. So one of the things that really helped to launch these bands and really get the scene going was Vito and his freak troops heading out to the clubs and putting on these very well-publicized public spectacles. And the people that's what initially drew the people to the clubs, was not so much who was, they didn't care so much who was on the stage, it was the show was on the dance floor. They were very instrumental in helping to form and launch the first band, the Birds. They provided them with their rehearsal space. By some accounts, they booked Vito booked their first concert for them, and they showed up at all the clubs to draw the crowds into their shows. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, these people were so popular that the club owners would let them in free, welcome them with open arms, because where the freaks were is where the crowds went. So by letting them in, you were guaranteed to draw a crowd to your club. You know, it didn't matter who the band was on the stage. If you had the freaks, then you were going to get the audience. So they were absolutely a very key element of this scene. And also, this one always gets me into trouble, is that people don't like want to hear this, but the reality is, and, you know, this is also documented, that a lot of these bands weren't necessarily all that talented when they first started out, which is why their albums were recorded by studio musicians, because they were not yet accomplished enough to perform their own songs. But, of course, you couldn't use studio musicians on stage. They had to play their songs live. So the Freaks also served another function, which was distracting attention away from the fact that the music coming from the stage did not necessarily sound the same as it did coming over the radio, you know? So, and they were such a key part of the scene that the Byrds actually took them with them on their first nationwide tour as part of the band, and actually took them on the road with them and had them doing the same thing in clubs in like Iowa or Kansas or whatever, which was what first introduced parts of the country to what would soon become known as the hippie looking culture, was the Byrds taking these prototype hippies on, and they are acknowledged by many people who are on the scene as the quote unquote first hippies. Beto's wife actually opened the first clothing. She's credited with opening the first clothing shop and selling what became known as hippie fashion. So they were absolutely a very key part of this scene as far as introducing the look and promoting the bands and launching the bands and getting the audiences out to see these bands. Very, very key part of the scene, and who had been like, complete, it was all but forgotten before I started digging into him in his book. And now he's got his own Wikipedia page, and I don't even have my own Wikipedia page, but Vito Palikas has his own Wikipedia page now. Sculptures prominently displayed on websites, and all of a sudden there's been a resurgence in interest in this guy who had been, you know, all but forgotten. He also just happened to be related by marriage to the Rockefeller family. Because, you know, when you think of the genesis of the hippie movement, you immediately think Rockefeller, right? That's, they go hand in hand, apparently. So, yeah, very interesting figure who was a very key figure in the background of this scene, and just happened to be related by marriage to the Rockefeller clan, of all people. Fascinating figure, to say the least, who, like I say, is now enjoying a resurgence in popularity now.
Because of your work.
You know, there's been some additional stuff dug up and thrown out there on the internet, about that since the book came out, or since the book, has been in the works. And now, you can find reports out there claiming that the Lookout Mountain Laboratories actually didn't just process nuke film tests. They actually faked nuke film tests, is what some of the stories coming out now are claiming, which is very interesting because, you know, before I started digging into it, nobody seemed to really know or care about Lookout Mountain, and now there's, this new information coming out, and, Vito Palikas was all but forgotten, and now he's enjoying this resurgence, and Admiral Morrison is another one. You know, when I started digging into him, nobody knew or cared who the hell Jim Morrison's father was, beyond the fact that he was some high-ranking naval officer guy. But, you know, beyond that, nobody seemed to know or care much about him at all. And now there's stories out there on the internet claiming that he was sort of the hero of the USS Liberty incident with Israel in, what was it, 1969 or something like that? I'm far from being an expert on it, but it was an incident where Israeli forces like opened fire on a U.S. ship, USS Liberty. I think maybe sunk it. There were some casualties and whatnot, and it was kind of swept under the rug. According to reports that I've seen recently on the internet, Admiral Morrison was supposedly like the hero kind of that incident. So it's hard to talk about this stuff without like sounding self-important, but I just find the timing very curious, you know, and the fact that I'm now getting criticized by some people for like not including this information in the book. You know, I've gotten emails from people saying, hey, you know, you talk about how Admiral Morrison was you know, key figure in the Tonkin Gulf thing, but you don't talk about how a few years later, he was the big hero of the USS Liberty incident. You know, why didn't you present a more balanced portrait? I'm like, because that information was not out there when I did my research, you know. It just seems to have suddenly appeared, you know. And the same thing with Lookout Mountain. I've gotten criticism from that. Why didn't you talk about how they faked the nuke test there? Well, again, that information was not out there when I was doing my research. The additional information on Vito that's not now out there was not available. Suddenly, you know, some of these topics, which had been very, very obscure topics that nobody was really talking about or cared about, have now suddenly become talking points in certain circles. And I find that a little curious, you know, that the timing just seems a little strange, you know. I mean, I don't know that it's all deliberate, but it certainly seems convenient that now I'm being criticized for not including information in my book that was not even available when I was researching the book. Yeah, it's been kind of weird to see this stuff sort of pop up.
Getting back to Lookout Mountain Laboratories for a minute, I watched a short video on the geology of Laurel Canyon, and a lot of the rock is sedimentary from the seafloor as the ocean receded, but left caves formed in different layers of the sandstone and as the water percolated down through the hillsides, including volcanic debris, compressed rock from deep in the earth, and the soil is from 12 million to 200 million years old. The point is, I guess, that the canyon is littered with tunnels and caverns that are man-made and natural. And it was said in an article, it was an added real estate bonus discovered when the elite began buying up homes all over the Hollywood Hills. So that might connect to Lookout Mountain as well. Even though it was in a fictional film called Wavelength, that miner said that he helped build Lookout Mountain and dig six stories down. It's interesting. So the geology of that area is kind of spooky as well.
There's been rumor and talk of secret underground tunnels in that area going back a very, very long time.
Dave McGowan is our guest. We're talking about his book, Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon, Laurel Canyon Covert Ops in the Dark Heart of the Hippie Dream. We'll return right after this. Out, our guest is David McGowan, author of the book Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon.
Two of the initial structures, the iconic structures that were first built across the street from each other on like one of the main intersections there on Laurel Canyon Boulevard and Lookout Mountain Avenue, is what became known as the Houdini House, which was built as sort of this Gothic castle with long rumored to just be absolutely laced with secret passageways, and secret tunnels, and underground lairs, and all manner of weirdness. And then right across the street from that was a structure originally built as a hunting lodge, and at one time owned by Western actor Tom Mix, became known as the Log Cabin, which is where Frank Zappa and then later Eric Burdon took up residence and kind of ran it as a communal gathering spot for all of the colorful Canyon characters to congregate in. And these were two of the very first structures built there way back at the early part of the 20th century, right across the street from each other, and long rumored to be connected by underground tunnels, that there were connections between, that you could pass between the two properties under the street through underground tunnels. A lot of stories about that dating way, way back. And the curious thing about that is that both of those structures burned to the ground a very long time ago. The Houdini House, I think, burned down in 1959, actually before the Laurel Canyon scene even took off. And the Log Cabin, which was in existence and in use through the Laurel Canyon's glory days, then burned down in, I think, 1981. And neither has ever been rebuilt. They both, the Houdini House still lies in ruins, the remnants of it, and the Log Cabin is completely gone, just an empty lot.
Oh, really?
And both properties are now fenced in so that you cannot see them from the street. One, they drew the really tall hedges all the way around, which is fairly recent, actually, because I photographed it not that many years ago. But now there's hedges all around it, and the other one is a tall wood fence completely surrounding it. And so both of these properties, despite the fact that they're situated in the Hollywood Hills and just absolutely prime residential real estate, it's worth a phenomenal amount of money, have both sat vacant and undeveloped on this main intersection in Laurel Canyon for decades now. I mean, literally, the Houdini place has been in ruins for over 50 years now, 55 years. And the Log Cabin for, 33 years, something like that. Which is very odd that nobody has bought up and redeveloped these incredibly valuable prime real estate properties, you know, that are, I can't even imagine how much they must be worth, particularly with the historic value they have. And yet, never been redeveloped, and they're shut off from public view, both locations. So it definitely raises some interesting questions about the nature of some of these iconic properties in Laurel Canyon, and, you know, mm-hmm. to what extent these tunnels and whatnot do in fact exist.
Or that could be a reason why they still sit vacant or in disrepair.
Yeah, it could absolutely. I mean, maybe there's still structures that are in existence underground. Who knows? It's not beyond the realm of possibility. And those aren't the only properties in the area that have long been rumored to, there are other properties that are rumored to have secret tunnels, secret grottos, secret rooms, all kinds of weirdness. Come across some very strange references in some of these houses. Errol Flynn's house was all set up for surveillance with secret passageways and secret cameras where you could just like wander around behind the walls and look into the bedrooms and bathrooms and stuff.
You been in there?
No, I think that one burned to the ground too, actually. All the good ones burned to the ground, you know. It's a good way to make sure that all evidence is destroyed, you know.
What are your thoughts on the Errol Flynn's house, and why do you think that was the case there?
Sounds like a compromise operation, you know. I mean, officially, you know, according to the conventional wisdom, it was because Errol Flynn was entertaining his own, you know, quirks, that he liked to watch other people, you know. And, you know, he would have people over specifically for that purpose, so that he could observe them, you know, in their private moments. But there are certainly far more nefarious explanations as well. Errol Flynn had very, very prominent friends. And, it sounds very much like the house that Craig Spence was operating in Washington, that was similarly, you know, built and wired specifically to gather compromising information on prominent politicians, law enforcement figures, and whatnot to keep them in line. You know, I mean, if you've got pictures of somebody in bed with somebody they shouldn't be in bed with, you have a great deal of control over that person, particularly if they're a public figure. It had a lot of earmarks of that same type of Craig Spence sort of operation.
Right. That was in the Franklin scandal.
I believe Nick talked about that. I know he looked into it. He's looked into Craig Spence. He's looked into the Jeffrey Epstein case. I don't know. I think he's looked into the Jimmy Savile case recently.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
He gravitates to those kind of stories.
Oof, darkness there. But what you're getting at is that it's an age-old tactic to control politicians and high-level people with blackmail.
Yeah, it goes way back. I mean, it's a very effective technique, you know. Yeah, you know, I mean, if you're a public figure with a reputation to protect, you know. Although in this day and age, you know, I mean, you know, you don't even know if a photograph you're looking at is even real. Or, you know, I mean, they could create, you know, I mean, they could put you in bed with anybody they wanted to these days anyway, you know, whether you actually were or not. So to some extent, you know, I wonder how much longer that's going to be an effective technique, you know, because it's so easy to fake, you know, photographs these days, and so difficult to know if what you're looking at is real or not, as we were discussing just a little while ago.
Yes.
Yeah, it is. It's an age-old tactic. It's been used and used quite effectively for as long as the technology has existed to allow it to, you know, to function.
That's what we find out in human trafficking stories and rings. In another area that Jordan Maxwell, who's been a past guest, he's an occult historian, he's mentioned in his book, The Matrix of Power, that the origin of the name Hollywood came from old magicians of Celtic England, and they always used their magic wands, and these magic wands were made of the tree, the holly tree, and so it was made out of Hollywood. So he says that's why today we still have Hollywood working its magic on us, showing us in movies how to view things and what we should think. What are your thoughts on that concept in relation to what you've uncovered in your book?
I would tend to agree. I mean, I basically view Hollywood anymore as kind of the propaganda arm of the CIA. Yeah, it's used to, you know, shape our perceptions of the world that we live in. Very much so, you know, and the media has a tremendous amount of power, whether the news or the entertainment media. And to think that that power would not be controlled is, to me, pretty naive. Yeah, so that's what Hollywood does. I had a meeting a few weeks ago at the William Morris Agency. They called me in, an agent, because he said his client wanted to discuss with me possibly optioning the film and TV rights to my book, which was quite a shock. But anyway, well, I was in there, we were talking about something, I don't remember what, and at one point the agent just looked at me and he said, "We're the William Morris Agency. We build illusions here," or something like that. You know? My first thought was, what movie did you steal that line from, dude? You know, but yeah, I mean, that's what Hollywood does. They create illusions, and not just benign illusions. They're illusions that have a very specific purpose and goal, which is to shape our perception of the world that we live in and how we understand and perceive our world.
You were mentioning in a private conversation that you've gotten a lot of unusual feedback on your book recently from these agencies. Can you briefly tell us about that?
Yeah, I've been contacted by three talent agencies. The first one was the Gersh Agency, which is fairly large. They have offices in New York and here in L.A. They actually contacted me before the book was even released in March. When the book was not scheduled for release till April 30th. And I got an email saying that from an agent saying that my client's a huge fan of your book and would love to talk with you about possibly optioning film nights and blah, blah, blah. And that never went anywhere. And presumably whoever the client was, which I never found out, must have been a follower of the web series, because the book was not even actually out. There weren't even any review copies of the book out. Nobody had even seen it at that point. And I was already getting cut. Yeah, which just absolutely amazed me. I'm like, are you kidding me? He's not even out yet. And May, I think, I got contacted by CAA, which is a much bigger, even bigger player. It's a creative artist agency, one of the big boys on the block, telling me that their client, who wasn't identified, was interested in possibly optioning the film rights and wanted to purchase like a 6-month option or something to develop the material and pitch it around town and see if he could get financial backing or studio backing. And then nothing ever really came of that either. I mean this isn't my world. It's all completely new to me, and I have no idea how these things even work. But for whatever reason, the first two contacts, they just didn't really follow up. And then most recently, I was contacted by William Morris Endeavor, which is like the big boys on the block. From what I understand, it's the one that's run by guy that the Entourage character was based on. One of the three notorious Emmanuel brothers, who absolutely reek of CIA assets, by the way. Mm. You know, Rahm, the Obama's chief of staff or something, and then the mayor of Chicago or something, or whatever it was. But that agency contacted me, and they have actually followed up and actually requested that I come in for a face-to-face meeting, which is very bizarre for me, of all people, to wander into the William Morris agency. You know, just this place that just absolutely reeks of money and power, you know. And I went in and met with an agent and a client, and whether it's going to go anywhere, I really have no idea. I'm very skeptical. I mean, I can't imagine anyone in Hollywood really treating this material in any kind of serious way. And some of these people that are mentioned in the book are still have active careers and still, I'm sure, have representation, some of them quite possibly with the William Morris Agency, you know? So I just can't see how there would not be huge conflicts of interest in them developing this material and not catching a lot of flack from their other agents and clients, you know? Very skeptical of, you know, what their true intentions are, and why I've been contacted 3 times by Hollywood when my book does not paint a very flattering portrait of Hollywood, and Hollywood definitely tends to protect its own. So I don't know what to make of it. I really don't. You know, some people have cautioned me to proceed very carefully, because the goal might be to buy the rights specifically to bury it, so that to guarantee that nobody else does, you know, try to develop the material in a serious way. Or they could be planning to acquire their rights to kind of fictionalize it and really sort of bastardize the material, water it down to a large extent. At this point, I really don't know. I have no idea what their motivations are or why they would be interested in doing anything with my work at all. For whatever reason, I've been contacted 3 times since this book came out. Yeah, make of that what you will. I don't know what to make of it. Really don't.
I want to add in that Ray Nelson, who wrote the short science fiction story, 8 o'clock in the morning, he was a past guest. That short story was the basis for the film They Live. He was telling me that there were 2 sequels to that film that the movie company bought the rights to. And so when a film company buys the rights to a story, no one can make a version of that film. It won't even get past production, because there'll be lawyers all over it.
They have exclusive rights to develop that material once they acquire the rights. Yeah.
So if somebody wanted to make a real... because your book is so extensive that it would be hard to encapsulate that into a film.
Yeah, I don't really see it translating to the screen as I mean, maybe as a documentary, but not as like a feature film or like a TV special or miniseries or something. I don't see how. That's another thing is I don't see how it would translate to the screen. Really, I've never been contacted by agents before. I've never had overwhelmingly positive reviews, you know, popping up on Amazon daily. I've never gotten anywhere near this volume of interview requests. Just a lot of things here are just very, very new and strange to me. So I'm still trying to adjust to it all, really. It's a weird time. All of a sudden I'm Mr. Popularity. So I don't know what to make of it. I really don't.
I think it's really fascinating, and it could be attributed to a change of consciousness of people, tired of being lied to. And you talk about the Byrds as, you know, a band that was thrown together in the studio and expected to perform. And there was not an organic assembling of band members. It happened almost like they were trying to put a formula together. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's another sign to me that this was a less than organic movement. Because, you know, when you think of a countercultural movement, like, you know, you think of, you know, struggling artists who, you know, or go through years of hardship struggling to try to get a contract with some indie label or maybe get some college airplay and, you know, maybe, you know, after years of hard work, you know, maybe eventually breaking into the mainstream and whatnot. But this was not like that. These bands came together just with remarkable speed. Just, I mean, they would arrive in L.A. and seemingly within like weeks, they'd be signing contracts and being given recording space and rehearsal space and provided with instruments and whatnot. And in some cases, particularly the Byrds being a prime example, they weren't even actually talented musicians to begin with. I mean, these weren't people that were sitting around, you know, like, hey, I'm a guitar player and you're a bass player and you're a drummer and we have similar musical tastes and, you know, why don't we put a band together and see where we can go? This was more like casting. In some of the references, some of the stuff I read, it's almost like referred to as a casting process. Like their drummer, Michael Clark, had never played the drums in his life. He was picked as the drummer because he had a physical resemblance to Brian Jones. And it was felt like that's what a rock star should look like. The guy didn't actually play the drums, but he looked like a rock drummer. So they cast him, you know, and, their bass player was drafted from a bluegrass band. He was a mandolin player in a bluegrass band, and by all accounts, a very accomplished mandolin player, but a bluegrass mandolin player is pretty far removed from a bass player in a rock band, you know? So their entire rhythm section, when they were first got together, had never played their instruments before. How can you have a band recording songs in the studio and performing live shows when they have no actual rhythm section, you know? There was only one actual accomplished musician in the group, who was Jim/Roger McGuinn, who was a very, very skilled 12-string guitarist who gave the band that signature 12-string sound. But he was really the only one. Crosby and Gene Clark were passable guitarists, you know, I mean, but certainly not good enough to perform, you know, on any kind of a real professional level. And this was, as I said, the very first band, the band that sparked this whole revolution. And here, you know, there was one actual accomplished musician out of the five of them. They did not do much writing at all initially. Their first album or two were largely covers, a lot of them Bob Dylan songs. Jim McGuinn was the only one of the five who played his instrument in the studio. All the other parts were played by studio musicians. So, you know, you had this band where the people were not actually proficient on their instruments when the band came together. They did not write their songs. They did not record their songs. Basically, all they, you know, the five guys who were featured on the cover of the album as quote-unquote the band basically contributed lead and harmony vocals to other people's music performed by other musicians. Yeah, you know, that's another thing that just really does not jive with the notion that this was an organic and very natural grassroots kind of a movement. It was one where people were cast to play specific roles and to create a specific sound.
You know, some of that music I really like, and it's odd now, you know, when I listen to it from that time, and now it's got that added layer.
I actually have a quote, which did not make it into the book, from a fairly contemporary drummer, not a hugely well-known guy. I think it was the drummer for, like, Toto or something. Remember Toto?
Yes.
I think they started out as Boss Gag's backing band or something and then made a name for themselves for a while with a few hit songs. But he one time said, and he was, you know, half kidding when he said it, but said he was devastated to learn that his 10 favorite drummers of all time were actually all the same guy. Because so many of the songs by, you know, the Mamas and the Papas, the Turtles, the Birds, the Monkees, and, you know, quite a few of these other bands were actually performed by the same set of studio musicians, this crack team of studio musicians known as the Wrecking Crew, who were in very, very high demand. These were very, very skilled studio musicians who could, you know, pretty much play anything you put in front of them. They are the ones that recorded. I mean, a lot of these songs that you hear on the radio to this day, if you're listening to the Mamas, I mean, there were no musicians in the Mamas and the Papas. Denny Doherty and Cass Elliott were phenomenally gifted vocalists, but they were not musicians. Michelle was neither a musician or a vocalist. She was just up on stage just to look pretty. I mean, that was really her only job. And John Phillips, you know, I mean, he could strum a little bit on the guitar, but he certainly was not an accomplished musician. So, you know, I mean, all of their stuff was played by studio musicians. You know, a lot of people don't like to hear that, but the reality is that when you're listening to these songs on the radio today, they were not necessarily played by the people on the album covers. They were played by uncredited studio musicians who never got credit for recording all of these just amazing songs.
Yeah, David Crosby came out with that solo album, and he's got a lot of other musicians, including Neil Young playing on it, a lot of others, famous people too. It's actually a really good album. Have you heard that?
I have not, no.
I recommend that.
People tell me that I'm a little too hard on David Crosby in the book. So, yeah, I don't know. He definitely has a massive ego by a lot of accounts, and definitely considered himself to be a very important member of the band, but you know, there are conflicting opinions on that. But no, I've not heard his solo album. I mean, obviously I've heard his, you know, the songs that he recorded with CSN and CSNY and the Birds, but I don't know that I've ever heard any of his solo work.
Well, David McGowan, you really uncovered an amazing chapter in the counterculture memory of the 1960s and what was going on there in Laurel Canyon that many had no idea was going on. And then you're bringing into popularity particular buildings, places, and areas that many have forgotten about. And I think that's very interesting. But more importantly, the military psychological operation potential of the 60s. And we didn't even get into Charles Manson.
Yeah, I know. Or Rodney Alcala, the dating game killer, the other serial killer with not nearly as close a connection. Charlie Manson was very, very tightly wound into the scene, much more so than a lot of people realize. Rodney Alcala had more tangential sort of connections, but both of them had very, very curious connections to the scene, definitely.
Well, listeners will just have to check out the book and read.
Yeah, we can't spoil everything for them. We got to leave them something to discover in the book, right?
Yeah, there's so much there, and like I said, it's overwhelming. I'm a little over halfway through, and it's intense.
I have people writing to me telling me that they're reading it for the second or third time just because there's so much. And it's a very difficult story to tell in sort of a linear fashion because there's just so many interconnections between these people, and the story just keeps like looping around and around and around, you know. So it's a very difficult story to tell in a you know, I tried to organize it as best I could, you know, in a logical sort of way, but there is just a huge mass of information in there, and it is kind of hard to digest it all in one setting. Or that's what people tell me anyway.
Well, I hope you hang on to the rights to this book for a little while, and until you find out the true motives of some of these publishing groups that are interested in your work. Can you remind listeners, where can they find this book?
On my site at, the name of it is the Center for an Informed America. The URL is www.davesweb.cnchost.com. Or just Google my name, Dave McGowan or David McGowan. It's probably the easiest way to find me. And there's also a Facebook page, facebook.com/weirdscenesinsidethecanyon, all written as one word with no punctuation, which I believe is a publicly accessible page. I don't know that you necessarily have to be a member of the Facebook world to access it. And that's where I posted my own original photographs and vintage photographs and whatnot to give some visuals to the story, the people and places, and where I've posted some supplemental information as it becomes available. And I keep fans updated on my interview schedule and any appearances, and anything related to the book and my work generally goes up on there. So those are the two places to either acquire the book or get additional information on the book.
Thank you very much, David, for being on the show.
Thank you very much, and enjoy the rest of the day.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Next week, the Fall Fun Drive begins. And remember, you can sign up to be a WBAI member or buddy and contribute before the drive begins from now until October 5th. And you'll have an opportunity to win a great gift and other cool things as you increase an existing donation. Visit WBAI.org.